All right, everyone, Buckhead and Beyond, Rich Kasten over here for a with Buckhead Business Radio X and a special episode featuring the Ritz Group radio series. And Trace is in the studio. Trace Crow with the Ritz Group is going to be our host today. I'll be a little bit of co-hosting, see how it goes, whatever. Yeah, so Trace, how are you doing today?
I am doing wonderful. How are you doing, Rich?
Unbelievable. Good fourth?
Yes, it was a wonderful fourth. Yeah.
Or as Larry's in the studio, Larry White, what was your line a little bit earlier? You said, how was your fourth, Larry?
I celebrated with a fifth.
Nice. We're all going to borrow that one. Yeah, yeah. That's a gimme. Yeah. We got witnesses. All right. So you've been doing a lot of stuff since the last episode with the, I know I was at the Shark Tank. What another great event that was.
Yes, it went very well. I actually was not in attendance. I was one of the few people not in attendance, but from what I hear, it went wonderfully. Larry can speak more directly to that. How did that go, Larry?
I'm guessing Larry's going to say it went well, but yeah, I was there. It was a good time. Yeah.
Well, I thought it really went well, even without Trace. I mean, yeah. That surprised me right from the beginning.
And I know we'll probably talk about it during the show, but while it's on the topic, you know, for those that our listeners not familiar with the Shark Attack, give us the 10-second elevator pitch, if you would, Mr. White.
Well, it's a networking group that meets monthly on the first or second Thursday of each month. And our goal is to network between companies raising funds and angels and other organizations that would like to invest and or help.
And you feature sharks and bait, right?
Well, our key thing is our Shark Attack, which is hosted by Bob Rathburn of Fox Sports South. He's the broadcaster, TV broadcaster for the Atlanta Hawks and WNBA Dream.
Yep.
And
folks can attend anywhere in Metro Atlanta. They just need to get a ticket ahead of time, right?
Well, certainly they need
to attend.
But we featured three very outstanding companies, as we always do, which are called Bait. And then we featured three outstanding sharks, and was real pleased that last year we brought in probably 23 outstanding sharks to our event that we would probably not have been able to attract to the event under any other pretense.
Right, right. So no, I've always enjoyed it. And we'll talk about that as the show goes on along as well. So, Trace, who's in our – let's do a quick roundtable introduction of who we have in the studio before we jump into those interviews.
Yeah, well, what we're doing today is we're sort of re-celebrating the 4th of July by doing a real cross-section of the business market. We've got Larry here who can talk to about retail markets. We've got Vic Uzumeri who can speak to technology and business operations. And we have Karen and Troy Burns from KB Photography and Le Couture du Vin. I think I'm saying that
good.
Close.
Wow.
Correct. My 4 years of French is coming in handy. Who can talk about the fine arts and, of course, wine, I'd assume, and French culture. So we're doing a nice cross-section of the American economy. We're going to start with Larry White here, who has been our honored guest before on this show. He should be. He is the president and owner of the Ritz Group, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, what the Ritz Group does, networking organization that connects entrepreneurs and angel investors through our monthly networking meetings, as well as our Shark Attack presentation, our online community called the Capital Community, and a whole host of other featuring opportunities. Thank you so much for joining us, Larry.
My pleasure.
So let's do a little recap about the 2013-2014 season of the Ritz Group. We usually take July and August off to recharge our batteries, let people spend time with family, and then come back hard in September. You mentioned 23 different sharks.
We did. Mm-hmm. And again, we do some repeats. Mm-hmm. But the key reason for the sharks is because they then comment on the bait. And the show is a ripoff of Shark Tank, if you will, except our sharks do not obviously invest their own funds in the company. They're there to evaluate the companies. And the companies are selected based on a virtual pitch tank. Which Trace Crow runs,
and what's the odds?
Others of us that go into the virtual pitch tank to select the three best bait. They pitch for 3 minutes, and then they answer questions for 10 minutes from the shark, and then we've included this year even having questions from the audience, along with some evaluation forms. And it's I've got to tell you, the people that present are really well-coached, well done, and I particularly like the three sharks that we had the last month on their ability to comment on what they thought was the investor readiness of the bait. And the audience gets a great kick out of that because they really get to see what's happening in the marketplace today. And the presentations are net, brief, and to the point, which every investor likes and one of the things that we stress. So it was that sets the tone for networking that happens before and network that happens after.
Yeah. I like to tell people when I'm kind of explaining what the Ritz Group does and what the value of the shark attack is that you don't have to present to get value out of it. In many ways, it's wonderful. You get to go watch someone else get cut up by the sharks and learn, and you get to learn from their lumps without actually having to get in the tank yourself. It's one of the great values of the show we're ripping off, Shark Tank, is that you get to see a little bit of what that interplay is about. I like to always mention, the first thing that Mr. Wonderful always asks is, talk about the numbers. Tell us about the numbers. And that's the thing entrepreneurs oftentimes want to avoid talking about. You know, what are your sales like? Well, we don't have any sales, you know. So I really think there's a great value in Shark Attack. Now, one of the great things we did, new wrinkles, you mentioned the crowd speaks. We actually had the crowd involved in the last three or four Shark Attacks. Mm-hmm. We also had, for the first time, we had a shark become the bait.
That's right. Dr.
Rodney Sampson, yeah.
Sampson was there, yeah.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I'm from Opportunity Hub. Talk about that, Larry. What was that like, seeing one of yours? And he'd actually sharked for us twice before, and then he was one of the bait. How do you think he did? What was that experience like for you?
He was sweating a little bit.
He was nervous.
He was.
Which surprised me a lot, because he's a very gifted person, a very gifted speaker. And because of that, we did not put him through the Shark Tank drill for 3 minutes, and frankly, and I'll say this with all due respect for Rodney, is that he got off track a little bit, and it did a fine job, but he got off track a little bit and could have been more to the point. He did a phenomenal job here on Business Radio X last show with the Ritz Group, and I wish he would have stuck to that script in his Shark Attack, but again, just a great job, and
but he has
a great learning experience.
But a phenomenal offering. I mean, so unique crowdfunding based on co-working space. I don't think it's been done or whatever, right? Yeah, and you're buying shares into ownership, equity.
Well, even more important is what Rodney is and his people are going to do with his 1,000 people for $1,000 is they are going to learn what crowdfunding for equity, and that's a big word, for equity is all about. And we all talk about it. But until you've been there and you've filled out the 450-page questionnaire that the government expects you to have, you really do not understand how difficult that really is to be compliant.
Yeah,
sounds
just
great. But
just as a spectator, I mean, it's not your typical crowdfunding platform just for rewards and perks. You're actually buying ownership and equity into it, right? So it's much more complicated.
Right. Sure. Yeah. He is funding the OHUB with a crowdfunding play with 1,000 owners that are in for $1,000. But as a result of that, and he's using Sparks Market to run the campaign. So what that really means, again, is he is using, under the Georgia IGE, Invest Georgia Investment Act, he's using all those rules. And he's also trying to be federally SEC compliant at the same time. So what this really means is we have someone who is really going to stress test the system. Mm-hmm. And I think that is of tremendous importance that we're all going to sit back and learn. In the meantime, do the math, 1,000 people at $1,000, and he's going to have money then to invest not only in the Oak Club, but he's going to have money to invest in other entrepreneurs that are coming through his incubator system and his club, which I think is fabulous.
A future Ritz Group success story, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty classic, kind of entrepreneurial risk-taking venture. I mean, he said, someone's got to do more than just dip their toe in this pool. Someone's got to jump into a cannonball. It might as well be us. I believe this is the largest crowdfunding for equity play in the U.S. I don't believe there's been one for $600,000. I don't believe there's been one that high.
Well, everybody's sitting on the sideline waiting to see
waiting for someone to raise $600,000
to be successful and for the train to actually leave the station. Yeah. And again, I applaud Rodney and his team for attempting this venture.
Yeah,
I think it's just smart. And again, He is going to, he's not a fan in the stand. He's a player on the field to make this happen and learn from it. And he'll share that story with us.
Absolutely. So, well, let's talk about the Ritz Group. You've got some big plans of your own. One of them you've mentioned before on this show is the Governor's Fund. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the, what do they call it? The working title. But you're looking to start your own fund to fill in this gap of the, angel investment. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was going to do crowdfunding, but Rodney beat me to the punch.
No. I think we all get shares though, just for this plug we gave him, right? Don't we all get shares? Yeah.
Don't we wish? It's important. It's important for this ecosystem that we fund at the angel round and at the angel level. It's the gap. It's the problem we all have. And for those of you that may not know what that really means, it's the pre-VC round for $50,000 to $250,000. It's after your family, friends, and fools are no longer investing in your company. So this is the round that we really need to complete within Georgia. Other cities have a good number and a good stable of successful entrepreneurs that are back re-engaged in the community, and this is the round that they are playing, Austin, Silicon Valley. In Georgia, we do not have a lot of successful mergers and acquisitions and successful IPOs and takeouts that they're back in the community. We have David Cummings that's doing it. We have two young individuals at Switchyard, were successful with Scout Mob. But those are the kind of people that come back and start incubators and give back to the community and seed fund young entrepreneurs to be the next success stories. We don't have a lot of that in Georgia. So creating that fund, going after angels to invest in this is one of the challenges that we in Georgia face. So we went to the governor and said, congratulations, Governor. We just had a major success story with AirWatch. 5 years ago, they had five people in Sandy Springs. They now have 1,500. In the next 5 years, they project 5,000 jobs. That's the power of entrepreneurial success stories. The bad news is we don't have a bench strength of other companies waiting to roll out to do that. And the problem is we don't have a fund. If you, Mr. Governor, care about creating jobs and could convince the corporate fortune, the 18 Fortune 500 companies that we have in Georgia to participate with a percentage of their VC investment funds into the angel round, then we could solve this problem and fill this gap and fund more companies and create more air watches. Mm-hmm. So we made that proposition to Georgia, and I was interesting to hear that Kasim Reed on Tech Edge did a beautiful job of explaining and understanding the problem with the angel round. He called it the VC round. They went to Silicon Valley and did a tour and came back and said, gee, we need to do more in this area to help fund companies. We need to get corporations involved. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking forward to meeting with the Honorable Mayor. But the Georgia Angel Fund is one of the initiatives that we've pegged for 2014-2015.
You're also building a platform using kind of the shark attack platform that you've developed with the Ritz Group. Mm-hmm. To actually start going after the corporations themselves. Mm-hmm. You're calling it the Corporate Entrepreneurship Program. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about the CIP?
It's really a corporate shark attack. And that got started when we wanted to take our successful shark attack that we've talked about during this program to the next level and give our bait more exposure, more eyeballs everywhere. And so we looked at going to Georgia Public Television. We then looked at a broadcast version of that using crowdfunding. And then what was presented to us was an opportunity to do shark attack for corporations. Now think about corporations for a second. And as my friend Stephen Fleming of ATDC said, corporations only have two methods right now. Number one, they're either all over innovation because everybody's worried about disruption. Don't be the next Kodak. Don't be a Polaroid. You've got to be very conscious of the fact that your customer is no longer your customer. It may be Amazon's. It may be Google's. It may be Facebook's. But the game is terrifically changing, and that's called disruption. Every industry has been disrupted in some form, and others are working on, i.e. banking, you know, with Bitcoin and with some of the advent of Square and all of that. They are changing, and it's impacting every industry. So if you're a corporate leader, you've got to be saying, how am I addressing this? The traditional areas of R&D are no longer intact. Okay, so therefore, that doesn't mean we just ban them, but we've got to have some new thinking. Where are you getting that new thinking? Is that coming from internal to the corporate walls, or is it external to the corporate walls? So one of the things that the Rich Group wants to do is we want to help corporations twofold. Number one, let's mine those great ideas that are coming internally in a corporation. Let's help your corporation think innovative. As Steve Fleming said, right now they're binary. Either they're all over innovation, or they're a deer in the headlights saying, what do I do? How do I start thinking in this new paradigm? The Rich Group can help. We run shark attacks. We've run, I figured out 40 to 50 shark attacks already, led by Bob Rathbun, professionally run, professionally screened. We can help the corporations internally mine these great ideas, culminating with 5 or 6 of the best, and have a shark attack for the corporation. And that's the CIP program. We also can include external companies who think they have a great idea for Rubbermaid or Aaron's or Home Depot, and today have no way to get into those companies to say, hey, I have just invented the next great thing that will launch your company into the next modern world. I don't know where to go. And now we have a venue with which they can interject their idea. We'll screen it just like we screen for a pitch tank on Shark Attack. And the goal was to present our Shark Attack to the major corporations, not only in Georgia, but nationwide. And then we added one great thing to that program. Where are you going to get your sharks? We're going to get them from Shark Tank, by having celebrity sharks come down and do the corporate program. And we're putting all that in place as we speak now. So that takes it to the next level. I have no trouble sitting down with the Fortune 500 CEOs and innovation officers, if they have one. And we'll put on a masterful 2-day event on innovation to avoid disruption. Okay, mine their internal and, if they'd like, their external ideas with a grand shark attack event. With major celebrities as the sharks, up to 3, with 3 of the corporate CEOs being the other sharks. And we'll run 6 companies through that program. We'll run as many as 130 companies through the screening process, but end up with 6 bait to a celebrity feature of sharks. So that's our, thank you, Trish, for asking, but that's our CIP program or our corporate shark attack.
Well, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I think what's great is you're taking the base offering of the Ritz Group, which are the networking meetings, which are still going to continue to go, and just expanding it and realizing that the networking is great, but it's not enough. And we need more beyond just making connections at the very base level of the pyramid. We need to be working up and making sure that money is flowing through the system and flowing efficiently. So I applaud you for working on these problems.
We have, and we had one major success story this year. Mm-hmm. We're so proud of the fact that Michel Fontaine of Transaction was able to secure through the Ritz Group and through Ritz Group investors an $8 million capital infusion.
So. Yes. Yes.
So that was our major success story for this season, and we certainly hope to repeat that going forward.
Absolutely. So coming up this season, which starts in September 4th, speaking of Stephen Fleming, we've got him lined up to be a shark at that very first shark attack, which, given his wheelhouse, we might as well make it about technology. Mm-hmm. And then in October... We're just beginning to talk about this, but October is the 2-year anniversary of Shark Attack.
It is.
So we are going to be blowing that one out of the water, pun intended, I suppose, and really trying to make that a fun celebration of what we've had. We've had 8 different companies that have come through the Ritz Group that have gotten funded in the last 2 years, from $8 million down to $10,000. The system works. It's not as efficient as we'd like it to be, and that's what you're addressing, but the system works. We're making the connections that make funding happen.
We do. We have over 20 people that are actively engaged with the Ritz Group on a volunteer basis. And my plea is always is the more we get involved that can take on projects, the more things we can really make happen for the city and for the state. And the Ritz Group has been extremely proactive working with all the other organizations to make great things happen for entrepreneurs. We'll never be finished, and we'll never have it perfect as the way Trace and I would like to have it. But, gosh, we're trying.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, Larry, mm-hmm. for joining us. We'll be calling you back for probably the top of the show or the end of the show if we can get a nice round table going. But next, we're going to move on to our next guest, Mr. Vic Uzumeri. Of Interactive Point of View, as well as Auburn University. You started at the Department of Management, then you dialed down to the Department of Aviation Management and Supply Chain while you started Interactive Point of View, or IPOV.
I was traded for future considerations.
our relationship has been relatively new, starting in last fall, but I've gotten to see firsthand the sort of work that you do with Interactive Point of View and how... just amazing you are about pinpointing the operational details and finding those choke points and helping smooth them over if they can be smoothed over and getting the right teams in place. So why don't you talk just a little bit about what Interactive Point of View does?
Well, Interactive Point of View at the moment is pretty much, it used to be a company in Auburn, Alabama that did e-learning for the Fortune 500. We did, I don't know, 500 projects over 10 years. I ran it as I was the largest shareholder and the president. And we basically built the company and ran the company out of customer money paid in arrears, which is about the hardest thing you can do. And we did that for a decade. And when I moved to Atlanta, I pretty much downsized it back to me. But I took a lot of the lessons that we learned in that setting. I'm an academic. Actually, I refer to myself as a recovering academic. I'm not quite through the 12-step program, but I'm working on it. And what I did for about 10 years was run a business on the side, but it was a little different than that. I really never made money. I never lost money. But I got to try – it was my private research lab for all the things that I was interested in studying that I could never get an NSF grant for. And so I got about $4 or $5 million over that period to try all kinds of different things that piqued my interest. And I've sort of brought the memory and the knowledge and so on of a lot of that to Atlanta when I came here. And now I'm working with smaller and bigger and new and some older operations just to try to take some of those lessons or even learn new and more interesting lessons. So I'm still half academic, but also very, very operationally detailed and money-based. So it's an interesting combination. I'm having a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, let's take some of that knowledge you've gained, and let's see if we can pick your brain a little bit and see if we can get some nuggets for our listeners. Which is more important, a great business idea or a great way to implement a business idea?
Well, I had a friend who was a CEO. And he had I've remembered this for probably 25 years. He said, business is real simple. It's what comes in, goes out, except what stays. And break it all down, and that's basically business. And we have, if you ask that question, you're implying that what comes in or goes out is more important than the other. Neither is important. What matters is the difference. So if you don't have a lot of income, or if you're, which pretty much defines every new startup entrepreneur and everybody else, then you better find a way to reduce the outgo. If you've got control in the outgo, then you can try and you're always trying to push up the income. And it's pretty basic stuff. The problem that's really messed almost everybody, a big companies, small companies, everybody in between, is that the technology options, the operational options, the human resource options on all of those have exploded in variety, shape, size. I mean, if we went back 20 years ago and you said you were going to start a business, okay, well, you know, if you were a phenomenal shopper, you'd be talking about you got a I got a lease on an office space and I got a 20% under market. And if you put it all together and you were fantastic, you might get a 25% under market. Mm. Well, you can start a business right now, and if you figure out how to do it totally virtually, you're doing it for $500 a month. It's a total game changer. But how many people know where all the pieces are? How many people are the power shoppers? And then are they the same people who can go out and sell the product, sell the service, sell themselves while being good at the other side? And I think as the academic in me says, this whole system has become much, much more complex, intricate, and rapidly changing than most anybody's prepared to deal with. And it's extremely stressful. And I think that's a lot of the problems that we see in most of the small business, that market. It's a question of who do you finding that information, how do you do it, and how do you synthesize it?
Well, you sort of answered my next question. I was going to ask you, how hard is technology making the job of the entrepreneur? The obvious corollary to this, how easy is it making it? It seems like it's both making it easy and hard at the same time.
Absolutely. So, for example, if I want, 5-10 years ago, if I wanted to have a whole IT system, telecommunications, email, visual presence, and all the rest, I'd be cobbling together 15 or 20 different services. I'd be paying an arm and a leg. I'd be dealing with about 5 or 10 vendors. So now you go to Office 365 and boom, it's there. Mm-hmm. Or you go to Google Business Apps and boom, it's there. Or a few others. And essentially you get 80% of what you need and it's $20 a month. And it's very well engineered. Those guys are good. So that part is much, much easier. What is more difficult is because these things are easy, everybody expects everybody to do all of these skills. Mm-hmm. So you got a restaurant? Well, you better have a really good website. You better tied into Groupon and you better have some specials and some online deals. Well, how many restaurateurs are really good at that stuff? Mm-hmm. So what you have is the technology on one hand greatly expanding the number of things that a normal everyday business is expected to do. At the same time, it's making many of those things so much more easy and changing the cost structures. Do you have a landline or do you have Google Voice? There's a big difference in the cost. So we're caught in that. It's a very interesting time, very interesting to help people, but it's also very interesting. This is my closet academic. I just sit back and watch.
It's funny. You say the recovering academic. It reminds me of a phrase I heard. People jumping out of the ivory tower. Trying to land. With a parachute and trying to land nicely. In the private sector. But every time you say the recovering academic. You said that to me before, and I think about that image of people jumping out of the ivory tower. Things as they're getting harder and easier for the entrepreneur, part of that, the technology is allowing globalization to happen at a very micro level.
Yes.
For the individual, it's no longer Hewlett Packard has to outsource certain sectors. Now an individual can start literally a virtual company with no one even on the same continent.
Yeah, I've been doing that for about 5 or 6 years. And mostly it's my own projects and my own stuff. I mean, I have one right now where I'm taking an e-learning course, very complex, written in a fairly hideous authoring tool. Well, everybody likes it. It's just really hard to use. And I'm getting it localized to, it's from in English, I'm getting it localized to Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. And the reason I'm doing that is because when they asked anybody else to do it, they ran screaming from the room. So I've got teams of translators and people doing work all over the world. I've got them in Shanghai. I've got them in Seoul, Sydney, Augusta, Georgia, pretty much everywhere. And they're actually working on, because the software license is very expensive, I have it running in Amazon Workspaces in the Amazon Cloud. So different people can get on it at different times of the day from anywhere in the world. And I only have to have one license, which is nice. So I can do, that creates a completely different, I'm running a global operation and it's just me. And pretty much, I won't say anybody can do it. Anybody could probably learn to do it. It's taken, I've got some scars and some scar tissue from previous mistakes, but it's there, it can be done. And that's one of the things, you know, the ability to source labor in small quantities, the, you know, go to the convenience store and get the snack size as opposed to Sam's Club and get the family pack. To be able to get your labor in that fashion and the flexibility it gives you for any size company, but entrepreneurs especially, this is a whole new world, and we're barely scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. I mean, I use Odesk and Elance. There are others, and there's other ways to do it. One of the things I think really needs to happen is, as much as there is the tremendous attempts that Larry's making and the Ritz Group's making to organize, I guess, the demand side of the equation. What are the markets? Why do people want to invest? We really need to start looking at organizing the supply side, getting the best practices together, getting people who know these tools together, getting the networking on, okay, I can't get more revenue. How can I cut my cost in half? Mm-hmm. I mean, still leaves the same amount of money. So how do we do that? And to me, that's really one of the, as much as there's untapped potential on the demand side, there's even more untapped potential for organization and networking and working together on the supply side.
And also, I mean, the new tools you mentioned, Odesk and Elance, I mean, in the right hands, with the right skill set, there's an enormous amount of intelligence and ability out there in the world just because someone's from Morocco does not mean that they're not have a ton of experience in our ability to do.
Well, I'll give you a very specific data point, Devin, just happened this past week. My son is a senior software developer in Toronto, which is not exactly a fringe technology market. Big city, high tech. His company, he's been doing interviews for the past 3 weeks for senior developers. And they've gone through, I don't know, 20, 30 that he's been involved in interviews. They found one guy who's fantastic. He was with me on Skype interviewing somebody in Armenia. And at the end of the interview, he said that guy would have scored number 2 and way ahead of number 3 out of the 20 or 30 that he'd interviewed in Toronto for a senior job in the 100 grand range. Hmm. This kind of skill set, this kind of knowledge is wherever the person happens to have it. I've hired a phenomenal voice artist, for example. He charges, I won't tell you the amount, but it's basically a pittance. He lives in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan. If he wants to do voice work, he has to drive to Detroit. It's 6 hours each way. Or he can sit in his studio and charge a lot less and do voice work and be happy as a clam. And he's got tons of work and he controls his day. He's actually on Hollywood. He's actually got IMDb Hollywood voice credits.
Oh, wow.
And acting credits. Now, there's a new world of shopping for highly skilled, highly knowledgeable people. And that's not, you know, the Odesk and Elance are trying to organize it, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more that we can do.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Vic. You'll be able to join us back for the roundtable at the mm-hmm. end of the show. But why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you if they're interested in getting you to be their personal labor shopper?
Probably the best thing is my LinkedIn profile.
Okay.
Which is, the standard www.linkedin.com/in/my-last-name, which is UZUMERI.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll have that on the site as well. And just while you guys were chatting, Larry and I were a lot of tweeting going on, and just had a retweet from this conversation in the UK right now while we're on the air.
So, globalization.
So it's crazy, yeah. And this guy has over 5,000 followers, whatever, in the UK. So anyway, media update, yeah.
You know, being from Michigan, born and raised, I can actually appreciate the desire to stay in the Upper Peninsula. If you like that lifestyle, if you're one of the 200,000 people who like that lifestyle, I mean, why not stay there if you can continue to work? You know,
there's a lot of Americans live in places that are a long way from downtown high-tech cities,
mm-hmm.
and they're not all lacking in skills, savvy, and knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're untapped.
Yeah. So our next guests are Troy and Karen Burns from KB Photographer. Karen Burns Photography, sorry. Yes. Speaking of traveling and globalization, we're actually now going to go across the Atlantic over to France here. Why don't we just jump right into it? Karen, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you started your photography business?
Well, I've been a commercial photographer since 1998. And basically, I just fell in love with it and started working for other people. And then finally had enough jobs of my own that I broke free. And basically what commercial photography means is I work with individuals, companies, PR firms, and so forth, sort of listening to their needs and creating a design, you know, creating brands and images they want for their branding.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, no, very nice. I've actually seen much of your photography. Michael Moore was supposed to be on the show, but he had an unfortunate car incident that he couldn't make it. He's all right. No one has to worry about his safety. But he works out of Club E sometimes, and I've been down there, and they have your photography all over the walls at Club E. It's absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. That's another realm of my business is our fine art photography.
Yeah,
which is sort of what sort of started my photography business in the first place. My husband and I love to travel. We travel a good bit, as much as we possibly can. And back in the day, we started off on our honeymoon traveling over to Europe. We did a 3-week car camping trip through Europe.
Oh, wow.
And we quickly realized that it was not possible to do that with just one camera.
Mm. Our marriage would never have made it. She's always there waiting on the perfect set of clouds to come in over the scene. And I'm, but no, we got that part figured out. And it's really been amazing to see how the fine art side of the business can kind of take control of the beast and pull it around. And that's what brought us to our latest project, which is La Culture du Va. It resulted out of that sale to E Club and to Michael Moore. Fantastic of him to give us the referral there. And we saw a need that we could fit. He needed motivational art for all those young minds that he's inspiring there. And this was something that we could look into Karen's portfolio and find lots of examples, providing him specifically with the imagery that he needed to go with his favorite quote. So we could say, you know, who are your favorite speakers? What are their favorite quotations? And we'll go and we'll find those images. And we really didn't have to shoot anything new. All of this is existing from the 15, 20 years that we've been traveling to Europe, traveling the States, shooting and just collecting those images while we're serving CEOs, while we're working with ad agencies, while we're shooting for Porsche Cars North America. We'll give them a plug because they've been terrific to us. They're one of our clients.
But while we were finding these images for them in the same process, even though we didn't have to shoot anything new, they really wanted, and we sort of talked them into doing a shoot of College Park, which is where Club E is, sort of bringing the community into their office space, which is what they're trying to do to begin with. And so they got us to go around College Park. We took about 3 days just walking around College Park, photographing black and white, actually film, infrared film photography and color photography, and brought it back to them. And they looked at it, decided which images they wanted, and added that to their collection that's on their wall.
That must have been a really interesting project for you because, I mean, College Park is, I really like going down there because it's, you know, it's got one foot in two different worlds. You know, you there's definitely, you know, it has a ways to go, right? But there's so much potential there. And when you get on that main street, I mean, you just see how much investment and how much attention to the details of, you know, kind of small urban life that the whole community is putting into it. It must have been a really fascinating project.
It was. I had no idea what to expect. You know, we live up in Marietta. Mm-hmm. So it had been years since I had been to the College Park area.
And when I pitched it, I just pitched, you know, well, maybe College Park theme would be part of this project for you guys. And I hadn't realized how much beauty there was that, you know, it has one of the largest collections of historical homes in the state of Georgia right there in College Park. And it almost all wound up under runways. And yeah. So, you know, one of the great things that we can do as photographers is document these unique spaces in our communities. And as far as architecture goes, it is very unique down in College Park. I don't know if I'd compare it to a Greenville, South Carolina, or to an Augusta, maybe a little bit of Madison somewhere in there. But just brilliant. And to be able to do that project for both of us was such a joy. It's what we love to do. Yeah.
Well, let's go back a little bit further to where this really started. You had put in your bio that you guys are high school sweethearts.
This is true.
And your business partners. It's been a long relationship you guys have had here.
We are together 24/7 for the past
40 years.
For the past 28 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. We met in high school, and immediately I knew that she was the one for me. It took, of course, quite a long time for me to convince her of the flip side, but I made it through perseverance, as they say. And, you know, here we are 29 years later, been in business together since 1997, 28. Okay. Our 19th anniversary is coming up on the 25th. I want to plug that.
Nice. Right into the wire there. Yeah. I'd say they have a picture perfect relationship. I don't know.
Good thing it's a still photograph, right?
So you guys, you know, you went on your honeymoon to Europe, and now you guys just got back from France, correct? France?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
To shooting Le Culture de Vin, which I assume is about wine culture in France.
It is.
Why don't you talk about that? This sounds like a fascinating project. My wife and I, we went on our honeymoon to Paris and took a day trip up to Brussels. So I'm totally fascinated with what you guys are doing here.
Yeah, well, this all started out of the E-Club shoot. And so basically, if we have a sale that comes in that benefits from art or comes from art, we like to reinvest it in that. And so we had kicked around for years going to wine country and shooting in wine country. And so the proceeds arrived in this fantastic partnership to create the artwork for E-Club, and we jumped on it. And so we actually went for the harvest. And so we were going through the Champagne region, the Burgundy region, the Rhone River Valley, Provence, and then jumped all the way across country up to the Loire before we finished, and we'd hit 7 or 8 different wine regions. The wintertime came, and it got really quiet and slow as normal, and I started going through all that footage. You know, Canon gave us broadcast quality HD video. It just came in our camera about 3 years ago. And so we started experimenting with it. So on this trip, which we've taken many times, we've carried 4x5 cameras, we've carried land cameras, we've carried Polaroids, and we've actually shot and done Polaroid transfers in the street of Venice. Now we have this new toy, which is HD video. So we not only shot stills, we shot HD. And over the winter, I started looking at the footage, and the story just kept jumping out at me. You know, there's something here, there's something here. And I did more research and more story writing. And I realized we had experienced a culture built entirely by wine. Not with a plan, not with organization. The vine grew everything in those communities. And it's now 2,000 years later. And they take what they want from modern technology, and they use it to their best advantage. But things haven't changed there. It's still 98% of the jobs surround the wine industry. Generations of families, 6, 7 generations, trying to keep that family brand running, trying to keep that family crest on a bottle and being sold in a market that's highly competitive.
Yeah.
Highly competitive.
Yeah. I was blown away when we went to Paris. You know, in Montmartre, there's that one little hill, basically.
Yes.
That's like hundreds of years old. And the, you know, the city kind of grew up around it, and yet this little patch of vines still exists. I was totally blown away by that.
It's what's even more amazing when you get out on the countryside and you drive just an hour outside of Paris and you start getting into the Champagne region, and every hillside, every backyard, there is not 1 ounce of land that's not covered in vineyards. And you ask these people, and we asked, you know, on this last trip, we asked a few people, you know, where would your town be without grapes and without wine. And they're like, nowhere. It would, you know, basically wouldn't exist. They said probably about 65% of the people in the town work in the industry of some sort.
Yeah, they can't imagine their town even being there. And it's been there for 2,000 years, if it weren't for wine, because it is everything in the community.
It's funny. It reminds me of a comic I just read the other day online, where it was you know, kind of a higher level discussion of French versus German philosophers, but in the format of a soccer match. And the very last still is the Germans have, you know, Marx and Nietzsche or whatever have been arguing with the ref, who is Confucius, about whether that was a goal or not. And then the last still is it pans to the French team and they're all just kind of sitting around drinking wine. And it says, and it appears the French, well, it looks like they're drinking wine. You know, that's just that's how they leave it. What's going to happen with this? What's the next steps?
Okay. So, we just got back, a week ago. I mean, on the 18th. Yeah. 2 weeks ago. And so it's taken that long to organize and get the computer ready to digest a terabyte and a half of, footage and stills and audio. And, so I've begun. The first step is to, kind of get a pitch piece out there because we've done this. You know, it was a concept, and everybody loves the concept, but nobody really wants to pay for it. And so, you know, we've gone the reward funding route because we're kind of scared of the equity. You know, hats off to the folks at Opportunity Hub for jumping in there. You know, I mean, for that very reason, we looked at rewards feeling like this is a safe, you know, spot of ice to dance on.
Yeah.
You know, and so we've gone that route. And now we're just kind of moving it all to ourselves. We've got the footage. It's in the bank, you know.
Yeah.
And so my next 3-4 weeks are editing. First, we're going to come out with a short, about 3-4 minute teaser that shows what we did. You know, we went and we visited champagne houses, burgundy houses. We visited a medieval castle that's only being built with medieval tools. And they're 17 years into the project. Got all the trades on site. You know, just a lot of really great stories. And so we're going to put those together and hopefully we'll be on the air in the fall. We're just trying to find that network. And if we can't get it on a network, then it'll be online.
All right. Well, great. Tell our listeners where they can kind of watch the progression of this project and learn more about your photography, and the series.
Okay. Terrific. So La Culture Du Vin, that's LACULTUREDUVIN. In French, a lot of letters are only seen and not pronounced. And that's one of them. So it's La Culture Du Vin, but it's VIN like vine. And then my wife's and our business website, KarenImages.com. That's really kind of the center spoke.
Sure.
That's where everything really began for us, was her deciding in high school that she wanted to be a commercial photographer. And so it's just been, you know, keep pushing that ball uphill every day. And so KarenImages.com is kind of the center spoke, and everything spins out off of there.
And if you, and one more plug here for Club E, if you guys want to see her work as well as see what's happening in College Park, head on down to Club E. It's right there. Definitely. On Main Street. It's a beautiful space. They're doing lots of great things. And of course, Karen's lovely photography graces just about every wall, at least on the upper floor where I saw. So now what we're going to do is, I like to leave 20 minutes and I always end up with 10, because the individual interviews are always so fascinating, but, we're just going to do kind of a round robin here. I mean, you guys, anyone can jump in, and anything you want, I'll try and get it started here. I was trying to find, originally the show was going to be very Ritz Group oriented. So it's just going to be, let's just, riff on the Ritz Group. But now that I have such a diverse group in the room, it dawned on me that the one thing that, knowing about the four of you that you all have in common here is that you like to travel. And I'm kind of curious about what your guys' opinions are about the role of traveling, broadening your horizons, getting a break from the office, kind of play in business. Because you guys obviously have nicely incorporated work and play together in your business model. Vic, you like to take, I wouldn't say they're sabbaticals because you're working while you're out, but you do like to travel. And then Larry, you love your fishing trips up north Georgia. So, any opinions on this? You know, I know I've seen a lot of things out there about, you know, the importance of integrating downtime into your workday, or else you get burnt out.
Well, travel definitely broadens perspectives. Immediately, it puts you into a culture or a place that maybe you have no experience in whatsoever. That doesn't run the way your neighborhood runs. You know, they have roundabouts instead of red lights. You know, and well, maybe I like roundabouts better. You know, I seem to get through that intersection really quickly. And so it's an opportunity to expose yourself to people that have a completely different exposure than yourself. I think that's always a great thing.
Yeah, and the way they think, the way they see the world and so forth is just completely different than what we're used to here. And I think that that perspective in general is very important to see how you don't, what you think is not always possibly the correct answer. There's other ways of thinking and seeing things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the, you, Karen just hit on point, which is that there may be many ways to skin the cat. And, you know, we have almost a business mentality. I taught business for a long time, so I read the same textbooks. You know, focus, focus, focus. You know, pick your approach, go for it, stay with the course, don't get distracted. Well, that's okay, but there actually may be half a dozen or a couple of dozen pathways between where you are and your goal. And it's really easy to get tunnel vision. And one of the things I think about travel is that when you do travel and you meet a lot of people who think differently, you recognize that it's not so much that mine's better or theirs better or whatever. It's just, oh, there is another or many others. And therefore, when you get into, for me at least, when I get into trouble, which is frequently, and I'm trying to dig myself out, then the more of those things that I've seen, the more I'm willing to believe that there might be a completely different, okay, take a sharp right turn or a sharp left turn or do something else. I think travel really broadens in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just a very small anecdote. My wife and I, we went to Edinburgh, and we thought, you know what? Coldplay is playing down in Manchester. That's got to be an easy trip, right? And we went in December, right? So we got off the plane and immediately got into a car with, of course, fortunately, we didn't get stuck with a stick shift, but it's, you know, everything's on a different side of the, I won't say the wrong side of the road, but a different side. And we're looking at the map and we're thinking, oh, this is a big yellow line on Google Maps. Clearly, this is a highway, right? But unfortunately, a Scottish version of a highway and an American version of a highway are significantly different. It was a two-lane road going through all the, you know, the kind of the, they call it the lowlands, but it looked like mountains to me. So it was a five-hour trip through the snow on the wrong side of the road on a two-lane road. It was interesting, to say the least. But, you know, those small things, it didn't feel small at the time, I got to be honest. I felt like a major difference. But it gives you this kind of interesting perspective, kind of like when you see the picture of the globe upside down and saying, you know, in space there's no north or south. I mean, either way is the right way to look at the earth. Mm-hmm. You just kind of get this skewed perspective on things.
Well, another thing I think is, you know, really interesting, especially in France, when we were, you know, going around a lot of the different wineries and champagne houses and so forth, is the fact that in a lot of ways they're using technology and they find, you know, great use in the advancements of technology. But yet they still use the old technology as well.
Yeah, they have a stubborn grasp on tradition.
That, you know, there's a lot of things. You may see a brand new vat, you know, that they put the wine in. Stainless steel tank right next to an oak barrel that they're keeping this specific wine in the oak barrel, but using the stainless steel tank for this specific purpose. So they love their history. They want to keep their history and they don't want to get rid of it. They want to enjoy every bit of what their history is.
They want their cake and eat it too.
Yes, exactly.
That's it.
Well, it kind of leads me to this question I kind of wanted to ask you, Vic, but I think it kind of generally relates to everything is that it seems to me that, you know, you're talking about globalization, ability to kind of pick and choose in labor markets. You can get really good programmers in other countries. But it seems that that globalization and technological improvement does is not, if not limited, at least there's spots where the old way of doing things kind of have to continue to exist. In the end, you can, I imagine, speed up the process of creating alcohol, but there's a certain level in which you just sort of kind of, you got to let it happen, you know? I was thinking about with globalization, if someone's making shoes, they certainly can get those shoes made in another country, but there are still levels of logistics involved, and there's still manpower involved in making consumer goods. I guess the question is, what do you guys think about this kind of interplay between the old world and the new world? I think we are in kind of a new place, like Vic said.
Well, I think, I mean, I taught logistics. I've got a checkered background. But all that means is that every problem now has more possible solutions. Hmm. So at the same time that you have companies that went offshore and started getting all their stuff in China, you now have companies doing onshoring or reshoring, bringing it back because they can add values or services, or they can do things in customizations or that they couldn't do. And I think one of the biggest challenges for everybody in business, I mean, the thing is, it's okay if you're, you know, if you're Walmart, you've got a few people lying around that can work on this problem. If you're a small company, you've only got yourself or a few people, and you may not have the kind of background you really need. But you nonetheless have all these choices, and that's really the challenge. I don't have an answer for it, but I think that's you can get your product made in China, but maybe you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And how do you decide?
I think a lot of times also comes down to the amount of disruption that's happening in the particular marketplace. So if you have say you're in the record industry and you now have YouTube and you're competing for free, you know, competing against giving music away for free, you know, you've got to get really creative in your technology. You've got to, you know, how do you compete against free? And in a lot of industries, this is now the paradigm.
Well, you sell it all on vinyl.
Well, one of the ways that we sort of compete in that market is, you know, I've actually reverted back to, and well, never stopped, but reverted back to shooting with film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we shoot black and white infrared film, which was the last factory that created black and white infrared film was imploded by Kodak in 2007. And we bought a bunch of film as they were imploding it. We bought up 100 rolls of film.
The story came on CNN and I immediately, you know, jumped online and bought 100 rolls.
And now, to get a roll of infrared film, it's $50 online. Hmm. So it's...
And then you got to find somebody to process it. So, it's, I mean, it's truly a dying art.
A dying art. And it's just a great way to bring back and create something new out of something old.
Yeah, it's reestablishing value, which is what it comes down to in surviving this disruptive economy is... redefining yourself and bringing value to your customers, or finding a way to create value using disruptive technologies. And I think that's what everybody's big challenge is these days.
Troy, from a Rich Group Shark Attack corporate, we hope that's true.
Yeah,
because that's what we're all about. And all of these corporations face disruption. They have to address it head on or reactively. Because of competition. And you saw that in the wine business. The reason they keep the old barrels is because that's the standard with which they've got to hit with new technologies and keep the standard available.
Well, plus, the advancement of technology, you know, kind of once the tsunami is kind of washed away and you're kind of taking stock of what has changed in the industry, it appears there is this sort of niche in almost every industry in which people want the vinyl. They want the old oaken, you know, old oaken barrel wine. They want, you know, scotch made the old way. Those sorts of things, they want it to exist in some capacity. I mean, look at the way agriculture, I mean, it was literally a generation away from most people not even knowing how it, like almost being a literal dying art. And now people are diving back into creating their home, home vegetable gardens and things like that, and relearning these arts that have been around for thousands and thousands of years.
I'm going to try to bring back the typewriter. I've been tempted. What I want to do is I want to sit at a Starbucks one day and just be typing away on my typewriter. Cha-ching! People looking at it like, really? And then ask the barista, what's the code to get online here with my typewriter? Yeah. But this is interesting. We may have to have y'all back. I don't know if Larry or I'm seeing a possible pitch here at the Shark Attack or basically for photography. I'm looking at next week's show. We have Chuck Wolf, the founder of Wolf Photography. Yeah, is going to be here in the studio joining us. And he's talking about the, you know, keeping up with the technology. He's created a new photo design bar. And we're going to hear all about that. But it's a whole new entry into, you know, keeping up with the times with his business that is, you know, he kind of evolved. So I don't know. I'm thinking photography. I'm thinking Shark Attack with, you know, I don't know if Chuck will be up for bait, but I don't know. We'll find out. Whatever. But I've enjoyed this show here today. I'll share some closing comments. We're a little over time, but that's all right. So what's up next on the horizon for
Well, we're off in August. Right. In September 4th will be our next Shark Attack. You can register already online if you go to ritzgroup.org. Other than that, have a wonderful rest of the afternoon and a great July. We'll see you back here in August, hopefully.
All right. Sounds cool. And once again, Ritz Group Radio, Ritz Casanova here, and Trace and all his folks here joining us in the studio today. And we've got another exciting episode coming up shortly. But meanwhile, we'll see you all next time.